truly be a fearsome creature, he informed her, taking her arm to help her over a felled tree, and then keeping it in his. A revolution, a world war, a remote jungle. I'm almost afraid of what's next. Paris, Ada breathed out. She could see the painting of the Luxembourg Garden so clearly, could practically smell the sweetness of the grass, the trees, the endless flower beds. After the rain, the jungle had taken on a stronger smell of rot. With the cover of clouds, night was creeping in early, spreading its fingers over the skies, deepening the gloom. What was her mother's, or her family's, connection to this place? Good God. Let me guess. The French Revolution. The Reign of Terror. He pinched the bridge of his nose. I'm not quite sure I'm willing to lose my head in this search. Ada had no idea, but at the terrifying rate they were going, she wouldn't be surprised if her mother threw in a guillotine as a challenge. She understood, sort of, that the point was to discourage travelers from following their trail. But, really? She stretched her arms, her back. If her mother had been tough enough to make it, then Ada would be too. Home, she thought. Home, Mom, and... what? Is that anticipation I detect on your face? He asked, with a small, knowing smile. She warmed at the sight of it, still feeling the soft, sweet touch of those same lips against her own. I don't mind this so much, she admitted for the first time. What they could do, their ability, was exhilarating and absurd and terrible and wonderful, and it made her heart race. It made her feel, for the first time in a long time, a drive to step outside her bubble of strings and competition and endless practice. It made her feel capable and strong that she'd survived this far, that she was still surviving. It made her feel curious about all of these hidden eras that now, if she desired, could be spread open before her like a deck of cards, only waiting for her to pick one. He kissed me. She'd kissed him. And it hadn't been an accident. It hadn't been a moment drunk with relief. Not entirely. It had felt as natural and familiar as his hold on her now. She'd known instinctively that they'd been building towards something, and she was only glad it had been the same something she wanted. And maybe she was a pirate after all, because she would fight like hell before ever voluntarily surrendering the treasure she'd already found. Glancing over at Nicholas, taking in his strong profile, one thought caught at the front of her mind, and she couldn't shake it free. It was a neat, easy solution, and she felt herself latch onto it in desperation. If Cyrus would punish him for letting her get away with the astrolabe, then maybe he should come with her to avoid it. Travel into the future, where he could have access to all of the modern marvels she took for granted. He could find work, go to school, and never see Chase or Captain Hall again. The family he'd made for himself. Never own the ship he wanted so desperately. It was selfish, she knew, to want him to come with her. And yes, it was mostly because she wanted to make sure he was safe. But she wasn't ready to never see him again, to never know what became of him, to never recapture the little groan he'd made when he kissed her. Ada would never kid herself into thinking that her time was some kind of post-racial utopia, where no one would ever hassle or harm him for the color of his skin. But it wasn't the 18th century. He could have a life there, one he could fully control. She blew out a long breath from her nose and reached up to touch his hand on her arm, still there from helping her navigate the moss-slick stones. You can't decide that for him. She could only make decisions for herself. Home was a clear path forward. Home was New York City, the debut, her mom, Alice, and... The air was cooler than it had been the minutes leading up to the storm, and she shivered hard enough for Nicholas to fold her into his side as they made their way up the path toward the arch of one of the darkened stone gates. Ada craned her neck back to better see the enormous face looking outward over the same jungle that had sprouted through the pockets and cracks of the stone. The pointed peaks of the tower were carved down in tooth-like layers, seeming to enclose each other like the petals of a lotus blossom. "Let's rest for a moment," Nicholas said, once they were under the cover of the arch's gate. The rain was still misting down around them, spitting, Alice had always called it. But the trees and structures were dripping wildly from the storm. She wanted a moment to try to wring out her dress, but she wanted to keep moving. Etta understood in a way she never had before that time held intrinsic value and that they were wasting it. She understood. So why was that small, secret part of her grateful that they were slowing down, even for a few minutes? To have one small sliver of time just to be near him, feel his skin against hers, hear his thoughts. Etta wasn't sure when the realization had come, if it had been shadowing her this whole time, waiting to be acknowledged. But now it was here. The sooner they found the astrolabe, the sooner she'd be gone. And he told her many times that he didn't intend to travel after this, meaning that gone would be for good. Stop it. We should keep moving. And stop thinking about options that weren't options at all. Stop stalling because she wasn't ready to let go of whatever this was. Mom. The more she thought her admittedly flimsy plan through, the more Etta realized she would need to do all of this in less than the 7 days they had left. She would need the element of surprise to get back to the future and pluck her mom out of harm's way. Not to mention she needed to use some of that extra time to figure out where she was being held. Etta, please, he said. I know we're losing time, but you need to eat, and I need to make sure that there isn't anyone else around. I'll locate the passage. You tend to the wound. The pleading quality in his voice pulled a protest from her lips, but as he stepped out, his gaze swinging over the city, she reached up and caught his wrist. I don't want to split up, she said. Please, just stay. I'll rest and eat for a few minutes, and we can find it together. His expression softened. All right, Etta. All right. She sat down in the mud and leaned back against one arm of the gate, as Nicholas settled across the other. She finally saw what he'd been doing when he had left her by the stream, cutting wood into bowl-like shapes. He held one out to catch the rain in its hollowed belly and passed it to her. Etta gulped it down in a single sip, then held it out again to collect more, as he did the same. Digging into the sopping wet bag, he removed his soaked shirt with a mournful look and passed her a bright little bundle. Bananas. Etta greedily tore into the first one, breaking its soft center into pieces as Nicholas gave up on wringing out his shirt and tugged it back on. Raindrops dripped from the arch in soft patters, catching the dim light. The water collected and flowed down the paths worn by hundreds of years of footsteps. In the distance, if she squinted, she could see pale-limbed trees growing into some of the structures, devastating whole sections of walls with their roots and branches. It was the return of the singing birds that made her close her eyes, simply breathe in the damp air. When she opened them again, Nicholas was watching her, his knees drawn up, his expression inscrutable. She could feel him drifting away on the tide of his thoughts, so she swam out to meet him. How about a kiss, hey? Etta liked that she was still able to startle him, just a little. The blank look of concentration broke as he barked out a laugh. I don't know if that's a wise idea. We'd never leave. There it was, the bold line of his smile. Her blood heated at the sight of it, and despite her own flirting, Etta felt herself blush at the promise underlying his words. But just as quickly as the smile appeared, it slid away. He reached for her injured leg, inspecting the healing cut. Nicholas shook his head as he unwound the wet bandage. One hand grasped her ankle, the fingers stroking the curve of bone, while the other ran up the length of the muscle, skirting around the puckered red wound. Etta felt the prickle of goosebumps rise in the places he touched. A different kind of ache hollowed the pit of her stomach, and the echoing heat rose up over her chest, her neck, her face, until all of her ached with the need to touch him in return. He leaned forward, pressing a faint kiss to a bruise on her shin she hadn't cared to notice until now. It's not your fault, she said softly. If she'd been paying attention, she would have been able to avoid the snake in the first place. Etta had never doubted that for an instant. The reply was whispered against her skin. I'll come to see it that way eventually. For now, let me wallow a bit. Etta smiled sweetly, pushing up onto her knees. She crawled the distance between them, listening as his breath grew more ragged. His gaze focused on her face. His hands curled over the top of his knees, and they were shaking as she put hers over them. Picking up his right hand, she pressed the soft kiss to the rough, scarred knuckles, and as he shuddered, she felt an answering shiver low in her stomach. She set his hand back down and rested her arms over his hands, trapping them against his knees.
"You make..."
Nicholas trailed off as she leaned forward, brushing a faint kiss across his lips. When he didn't lean back, when she breathed in his soft exhale, she did it again, applying a little more pressure. She felt him try to tug his hands out from under hers, but she held firm, watching as a look of amazement spread over his face. She worried, just for a moment, that she was trading one obsession for another, trading the high of performance for this strange sense of freedom, for the way a wild, unfamiliar part of herself was opening up around him. He made her feel brave. He let her be who she was unconditionally, without judgment. And because of it, she felt life shifting around her into something that felt much more beautiful and clear. He said the words so quietly she wondered if she'd imagined them.
"Then it's the same for you."
She ran her nose down the length of his, and there wasn't a part of her that wasn't humming, that wasn't rejoicing in this tiny, perfect symphony of happiness.
"Release me," he said hoarsely.
He was strong enough to pull his hands away by force. Her thoughts spun in a dizzying dance of want and confusion and desperation.
"Etta."
He leaned forward and captured her lips, stealing the kiss himself until she had to come up and gasp for breath. Nicholas pulled her back under, and this time she did let go, only to take his beautiful face in her hands, to let his hands tangle in her hair, around her shoulders. If the sky had opened again just then, Etta didn't think she'd feel the storm at all, not when she was caught so deeply in this. Time was tugging at her back, insistent and demanding, passing faster and faster. But all she wanted was to stay there, to smell the sea on his skin and press her face to that part of his neck where it seemed to fit perfectly, as if it had been made to hold her and her alone. If there was a place to go where time might forget them, she wanted to find it. He was breathing hard enough that she felt his heart jumping against his ribs, and she knew hers was doing the same. She turned, running her lips along the curve of his ear, her fingers pressed against the solid muscles of his back.
"We can't," he said into her hair, half pleading. "We can't make this so bloody difficult."
Too late. What was she even doing, torturing herself with what she couldn't have? She could fight this, whatever force it was that dragged her back to him, that knotted their yearning. Attraction. She would go home, and he would go home, and whatever kept pulling them back together would be dissolved by distance and time and death. "He's been dead for hundreds of years by the time you're born." They weren't supposed to have ever met. Maybe that's why she wanted it so badly. It was impossible, and both of them were too stubborn to let themselves be told what they could and couldn't have. Right now, she didn't care. Right now, he didn't care. Etta wasn't sure who reached for the other, only that she was kissing him again, until her lungs burned and her body ached for him to be closer. Her back collided with the wet stone of the gate, and she imagined she could taste the storm in him, the battering winds of desperation and frustration that met and matched her own, blow for blow. His lips softened against hers as his hands slid from the nape of her neck to brace his weight against the wall, trapping her against it. She felt Nicholas give in to the slow exploration of her. The tenderness of his touch made her hands curl in his wet shirt. The world dissolved around her, as if she'd stepped through another passage. Passage. She pulled him closer, trying to will the world away. Nicholas made a small, hungry noise in his throat. Astrolabe. Sliding her hands around his waist, her fingers went searching for the warm, bare skin beneath his shirt. Mom.
Etta,
he was murmuring, turning her name into a secret.
Etta, we... The passage.
There's no time.
I know,
she managed to say against his lips. Etta didn't have the strength to push him away, to end it, the way they both knew they had to. Even now the knowledge only filled her with more desperation, made her unbearably feverish beneath her skin. She gripped him tighter, refusing to let go. No time for this. This had to stop the same way it had begun. Together. She felt him slow. The lazy, drugging quality of his kisses faded to a ghost of a touch. No time for us.
She let out a shaky breath and turned her face away. Nicholas leaned down and rested his head against one of his hands, trying to catch his breath. After a while, he said, his voice hollow,
"Rather proved my earlier point, didn't I? We need to go. The Four Ironwood sends a traveler after us, if he hasn't already."
Etta kept her gaze on the wet stones, the winding rivulets of water slipping between them, and nodded.
"Why this?"
The thought seared through her.
"Why him? Why?"
"Do you know where we're meant to go?" he asked quietly.
He lifted a hand to touch her face, but let it fall away, as if thinking better of it.
I think we're looking for the Elephant Terrace," she said when she'd found her voice. "That's what my mom's painting was of, a view of it from slightly above. But I don't know where it is inside, though."
"That's all right. We have a way of finding it quickly. I imagine we're close enough for it to catch the resonance."
Nicholas reached into the bag and blew into the harmonica. The call of the passage echoed back twofold, volleying through the empty stones around them. Etta strained her ears, picking through the layers of the call, until she could orient herself in the direction it was coming from. There was something about it, though, a hum she didn't recognize. Her whole body tensed.
"Does it sound different to you?"
"It sounds as atrocious as it always does."
Nicholas shifted the bag back onto his shoulder.
"Shall we?"
She shook off her concern and followed him through the abandoned city. A part of her wondered how long it had taken the jungle to erase most of the evidence of human life. Etta wished she could remember the exact reason why both Anchor Tom and Anchor Wad had been abandoned. But she thought it had something to do with war, and the ever-shifting tide of power that eventually brought down even the greatest of civilizations. Without the resonance the passage had bounced back to them, she wasn't sure she would have been able to find it at all. While her mom had shown her maps of the city, pointing out where she'd done her dig, if there had even been a dig in her past at all, Etta thought. The pathways were nearly so overgrown, the stone and remnants of wooden structures in such disrepair, she just barely recognized the Bayon when they passed it.
"That's the Bayon,"
Etta explained, catching Nicholas's appreciative look at the massive structure. "My mom said that there are over 200 faces on it. If you look, some people believe many of them are of the king who built the city, Jayavarman the Seventh."
"I suppose that's one way to ensure you'll be remembered," he said. "He's a rather handsome devil. How do you think I'd look on one of these temples?"
Etta laughed.
"How would I look?"
"I couldn't bear the thought of even your face here left alone, for only the jungle to admire."
He shook his head.
"Never. I'd never allow it. The only thing is to hire an artist to turn you into a figurehead for a ship, so some part of you will always be venturing out to see where you belong."
Etta was so stunned by this earnest speech, she lost all capacity for speech herself. He seemed to notice and ducked his head in scowling embarrassment.
"All right," she said. "But only on the condition that you give me some kind of a sword, maybe even an eye patch. Use your best direction on what will be more terrifying for your future prey."
"I," Nicholas agreed, exaggerating and deepening his accent. "The very sight of you will strike fear in the hearts of all men." She grinned.
The bas-reliefs along the sides of the temple were darkened by rain and clinging green plants, but Etta could still make out the carved panel of what looked to her like a market, people bartering and selling, with fish swimming above them. They walked quickly past images of warriors marching alongside elephants to war, a scene of an enormous fish swallowing a deer, and what had to be a royal procession, following the barest hint of a footpath through the mud. The rain had washed away any evidence that the monks had ever been there, but Nicholas didn't relax, didn't lower his guard, until they spotted the passage's glimmering wall of light floating above what Etta knew was the Elephant Terrace, the same one her mother had painted and hung above the couch in the living room. The Elephant Terrace stood a short distance away from her mind reached for the name, the Vimarnakas, the city's first temple, the one that housed a sacred tree buried within it, where her mother had actually done her dig. She eyed the steep stairway that hugged the stacked layers of the temple. The stone seemed almost red compared to the elaborate gray structure that sat on top of it. What was her family's connection to this place? She turned back toward the raised platform in front of them, accepting a hand up from Nicholas as he climbed it. The king had used this terrace to survey the march of his victorious army.
and carved around it, chipped away from the supports, were elephants. The platform looked as if it was resting upon their backs.
"Stand on the shoulders of memory," Nicholas breathed out.
The clue made sense to Etta now. Elephants were celebrated for their memories, but it didn't explain the way the passage made the air feel like it was hiccuping. The sound coming off it, its usual bellow of thunder, almost drowned out a second lower beat. It reminded Etta of the way that you could sometimes feel your pulse in another, unexpected part of your body.
"Whatever is the matter?" Nicholas asked.
"Nothing, just..." Etta looked back at the city, slowly turning to take in the sight of the trees that seemed as if they were stepping over the walls, the faces on the bayon that watched her with tranquil, serene smiles. When in her life would she see this again, see the city at this moment, before humanity came flooding back into it? Never. This was the danger, the seduction of time travel, she realized. It was the opportunity, the freedom of a thousand possibilities of where to live and how to start over. It was the beauty open to you in your life if you only just stopped for a moment to look. These things drowned out even the most basic dangers of collapsing passages, of being lost, of finding yourself in an unfriendly time.
"It's time," Nicholas said quietly, offering his hand.
Again she felt her desire for music swelling in her like an ache. Her fingers pressed against her side, and she imagined how she would try to coax a song of hidden depth and warm, wild life from the strings. And when she passed through the damp jungle air into the electric, shivering fingers of the passage, she mourned the fact that she would never see this place again. Paris, 1880. 15. Etta found herself awake, sprawled out on the grass beneath a generous cover of shade, ears ringing, head throbbing, but awake. And not just awake, but also free of the sickening swoop of dizziness that had come hand in hand with the last passages. She sat up, brushing a red leaf out of her hair. The crisp autumn air was practically golden as it came down through the fiery shade of the leaves overhead. When she turned, Etta wasn't the least bit surprised to see the Luxembourg garden laid out in front of her, a vision in the warm afternoon light.
"You were correct."
Nicholas was sitting with his back against the same tree, rubbing his face.
"C'est le jardin de Luxembourg."
Etta couldn't stop her small, ridiculous smile.
"Say it again."
"Pardon," he said.
"Say it again," she thought.
His voice did something incredible to the French language. The words moved through her like warm honey.
"C'est le jardin de Luxembourg," he repeated, visibly bewildered.
"So, what day do you think it is?"
"The same day as when we woke up in London," he answered.
He knew what she was thinking. Etta's dress had torn in several places at the hem, and had turned from sky blue to a brown usually reserved for muddy rivers. Her boots were crusted with dried dirt and mulch, and she didn't need to touch her hair to know that it was standing straight up in several places. Nicholas took a quick look around, to make sure they weren't being watched, and began to smooth her wild waves down, collecting her hair at the nape of her neck. He was careful not to touch her skin as he pulled a ribbon from their bag and used it to tie the mass of it back. Etta was careful not to give in to the urge to lean against his shoulder and wrap her arms around his narrow waist.
7 days. Less.
"Shall we?" she asked.
"Let's make a slow and careful approach of this," he said. "I want to make sure we don't raise too much alarm."
And she wanted to make sure that it would be safe for him. The odd thing was, as they passed through the last of the trees and stood on the edge of the path, Etta couldn't get a sense of where they were in time. The women's fashions were somewhere between the 19th and 20th centuries. Brightly colored, finely tailored jackets with long skirts that were bustled up in the back, or decorated with layers of ruffles, exaggerating the natural curves of their bodies. Hair was hidden beneath bonnets and hats, all decorated with flowers and ribbons. The men accompanying them, or playing games of cards or chess, wore suits and top hats. Some strolled around a large basin, a central reflecting pool, with canes. Children ran through and around the artists and their easels. Women sat beside one another on benches, talking idly. It was not all that different from the Luxembourg garden of her own time. At the head of the garden, past the large reflecting pool, was the palace itself, as stately as she remembered, standing like a section of Versailles that had broken off and wandered away.
"We should be all right," Nicholas said, keeping his voice low. "The trick is not to meet anyone's eyes."
It was like he'd been caught on a hook. One minute he was standing beside her, as tense as any of the marble statues, and the next he was running, off like a shot, jumping over the nearest bed of flowers and ruffling their bright heads. Women shrieked as he passed, men screamed after him. Nicholas didn't bother with the crowded path around the reflecting pool, but simply cut through the water, splashing through the shallow pool and leaping out on the other side. Two little boys attempted to follow him before being snatched back by their nannies. For a moment, Etta stood still, her arm outstretched after him. Something cold was pressed into her palm by a passing, kind-faced old man. A few coins.
"Wait, no,"
she began, trying to give them back.
"I'm not... never mind."
She pocketed the coins and ran after Nicholas, trying to let the sting of being mistaken for a beggar roll off her shoulders. First time for everything and all that. It was easy enough to follow his dark shape through the crowds as he ran past the statues of French queens, toward the path that would lead them to the nearest road. Finally he stopped, but his shoulders blocked out what, exactly, he'd been chasing, until Etta was standing directly behind him, with the gawkers collecting there. It was a woman, older, if the lines on her face were any indication, but elegantly tall. Her dark skin was the shade of deep earth, her hair hidden beneath a plain sort of hat. Compared to the other women around her, she was dressed simply, almost as if the outfit was a uniform. An overturned basket had crashed at her feet. Etta moved quickly, trying to gather up the tins that had gone rolling out of it down the path. When she turned, Nicholas's hand was still on her shoulder as he spoke in gruff French.
"Je suis vraiment désolé. Je croyais... ma mère."
At that, the look of terror on the older woman's face disappeared.
"De rien,"
she smiled at him, patting his hand.
"Tu es un cher garçon."
Etta righted the basket, passing it back to her wordlessly. Nicholas looked stricken, as if the whole of his chest was caving in.
"Au revoir,"
the woman said with a small wave.
Au revoir,"
Etta managed, watching her as she hurried away. Nicholas stared after her, swaying on his feet. Water dripped off his pants, out of his shoes.
"It'll be best if we go unnoticed, huh?" she said.
Nicholas didn't reply. He just stood there, rooted in place. Better to keep moving than risk being seen by guardians nearby, or by the police. Etta hooked her arms through his and led him off the path, weaving through the trees and picnickers until she found a spot she recognized, the Medici Fountain, and the long pool stretched out in front of it. She negotiated his big body onto the nearest bench.
"Are you okay?"
He shook his head, swallowing. Etta looked through the bag at his side, digging through it to find some kind of food to give him. Nicholas was in some kind of shock. Turning up nothing, she said, "I'll be right back." With the coins the old man had given her, and some careful gesturing, she was able to buy a loaf of bread and a small glass of lemonade from a vendor. A sympathetic man was willing to move the queue behind her along by translating, and giving her the last bit of money she needed. By the time she made it back to Nicholas and the fountain, he'd come back to himself and was on his feet, pacing, looking for her. The relief that crashed over his features made her rush over to him, careful not to let too much of the lemonade slosh out onto her hand. He pulled the food and drink out of her hands, setting them aside, and wrapped his arms around her. She did the same, standing on her toes, arms locked around his shoulders, and did what she'd wanted to do from the moment she'd left him there, hold him until he finally stopped shaking. She didn't care about witnesses. When she rocked back onto her heels, releasing him, she gestured to the bread.
"I paid good money for that. You'd better eat every last bite."
"Every last bite," he promised, even as he tore a piece off for her.
He looked at his seat again with a sheepish look around them.
"I have to confess, I'm surprised they haven't marked us as vagrants and thrown us out yet."
Etta decided not to tell him where the money for the bread and drink had come from. Instead, she watched his fascinated, puckered reaction as he took a sip of the lemonade.
"My God,"
he coughed, pounding his chest.
"When does it stop burning?"
"In all of your travels, you never had lemonade?" she asked.
"What, only beer and wine for you?" "Better than diseased water."
He tore the small loaf in half, bringing his piece up to his nose to smell it. The obvious pleasure on his face gave her a flush of happiness, too.
"What happened?" she asked softly.
He took a steadying breath, looking out over the water again.
"I thought that woman... I caught a glimpse of her as she was hurrying across the park, and for an instant I truly believed she was my mother."
Etta felt the world shrink around them painfully, tighten around her shoulders until it hurt even to breathe.
"I know it sounds mad, that it was bloody reckless, but the resemblance was uncanny. Of course it wasn't her. She's long dead by this year. I know it, but it was as if..."
He folded his hands in his lap, shaking his head.
"It was as if, for a moment, the clouds of the past cleared and gave her back to me."
Etta leaned against his shoulder, wishing there was something she could say. "Did you ever find out what happened to her?" He nodded.
"While I was gallivanting with Julian, Hall finished the work I'd begun in searching for her. She died in South Carolina in 1773, of a fever."
Nicholas managed to choke out one last word.
"Alone. I'm not even sure where they buried her. Hall thought that, even with my papers, it was too dangerous to attempt to find the grave."
"I'm so sorry," she breathed out. He rested his face against her hair.
"I haven't many regrets in my life," Nicholas said. "And I suppose I should be grateful that there's just the one. As much as I do blame Ironwood, I can't divide myself from the guilt. I should not have accepted Ironwood's offer and left the sea to travel. Then perhaps I might have found her in time and purchased her freedom. Julian would not have fallen. I'd be free of every shackle this family has tried to place on me."
Etta understood all too well what this kind of regret felt like as it burrowed deep inside of you. She would do just about anything to relive those last few moments with Alice, but even traveling was out of the question. She couldn't exist in the same place, the same year, twice. But Nicholas hadn't been in 1773, at least not all of it. She was almost afraid to ask. "Isn't there a passage you could take to that year? I know you can't save Julian, that it would change too much. And if she was sick, not even you could have kept her alive. But maybe... maybe it would bring you both some peace." He shook his head.
"There isn't a passage to that year. I've thought this through 1,000 times. I've considered how I could get a message to Hall in the past, to keep myself from going. But as much as I wish I'd made a different choice, I can't bring myself to be quite that selfish, to risk all of those changes rippling out."
"When you told me I couldn't save Alice, you spoke from experience."
"I should have told you the whole of it," he murmured.
This memory was clearly something he kept buried deep. A dagger he kept wrapped in layer upon layer of distraction, to avoid cutting himself by brushing up against it. She understood and respected that. "It's an easy fix, though," Etta said. "Before, you didn't have the astrolabe." He sat up, pulling away. She'd managed to shock him again.
"Etta."
"No, don't shake your head like it's impossible. It isn't. We could take the time to create a passage for you,
before we give it to Ironwood,"
he prompted, with obvious suspicion in his eyes. She nodded, hating the lie. "This is all simpler than you want to think it is." His lips compressed into a tight, unhappy line. Why couldn't he believe that this was a true possibility, that he could have everything he wanted? Why was he reluctant? Nicholas didn't want to continue traveling, but one last trip to see his mother, to be with her and ease his mind. Wouldn't that be worth it?
"Regardless, we need to find the bloody thing first, which means that it's especially lucky that I figured out the clue."
Nicholas spread his hand out on the stone banister that ran along the water's edge.
"You brought us right to it."
"You mean..." Etta followed his gaze back to the fountain. "Bring a coin to the widowed queen."
"This is the Medici Fountain, built by Marie de Medici, the widow of Henry IV of France, isn't it?"
Nicholas gestured the fountain. Julian brought me here to chase the skirt of some girl he'd seen on the street. If there's one thing that's true of all Ironwoods, they love to lecture and give unsolicited history lessons. Etta nodded.
The stone on the fountain had been carefully worked. Two figures sat atop columns that were interspersed with more sculptures. At the very center were three more statues, Polyphemus surprising Acis and Galatea, with the bulking bronze cyclops Polyphemus peering over a boulder, and the ill-fated lovers carved out of white marble. Her mother loved and specialized in the conservation of works from the Italian Renaissance, and this fountain had used elements of that in its classic grotto style. To Etta, it was an obvious connection. Nicholas blew out another ragged breath, burying his face in his palms. Etta reached over, stroking his hair in reassurance. She wasn't sure what was upsetting him more, that he had drawn so much unwanted attention to himself, or that he'd let himself get his hopes up. When he still seemed distraught, his muscles tensed, she took his hand and threaded their fingers together. He returned her soft squeeze with one of his own. "Bring a coin," she muttered. "Of course, you brought coins to fountains to make a wish." "I think you're right." She pulled the harmonica out of the bag again with her free hand and brought it to her lips. Her shoulders locked as she braced herself for the deafening ripple of noise to wash over them.
"Wait," he said before she could blow into it, his hands closing over her wrist. "Etta, I need to tell you something."
The sudden crack of the passage sent them both to their feet. The harmonica skidded to the edge of the water, forcing Etta to dive in order to save it. Nicholas's arm lashed out as she started to rise, keeping her down as he craned his neck around.
"I didn't," she started to say.
"I didn't play the chord." But if the passage was letting out its usual blistering cry, then... Two figures stepped out from behind the fountain, dropping bags and shrugging out of black tuxedo jackets. One, a tall, chestnut-haired man, clawed at the bow tie around his neck, laughing deeply at something the shorter, blonde young man beside him was saying. Both were handsome, and there was something familiar about them. Etta couldn't place it. Not until the one with the dark hair looked up, and his icy blue gaze fixed on her. In that moment, she wasn't sure who was more shocked. Nicholas, who sucked in a sharp, alarmed breath, her, as she realized that this man had the same eyes as Cyrus, or the man himself, as he went chalk white and called out,
"Rose!"
Nicholas hauled her up from the ground and said a single word,
"Run!"
Nicholas's longer legs ate up the ground with ease, forcing her to double her speed just to keep up with him. The men and women taking in the sunset scattered.
"Rose!"
the man shouted.
"Rose!" "Damn it all!" Nicholas swore.
The gunshot sent the Parisians scattering in every direction, like a colorful array of feathers. Another shot rang out, blistering the skin of the tree beside Nicholas, and sending down a shower of leaves and bark. Before she could think about why it was a bad idea, Etta reached across Nicholas into the leather bag. She closed her fingers around the handle of the gun and whipped it out. The back of the gun's body had a kind of hook. Her thumb caught it, pulled it back, and with the slightest pressure on the trigger, a bullet exploded from the gun. The reverberation shot up through her bones, her eardrums winced at the deafening sound. But it had the desired effect. The travelers broke off from behind them.
"Bloody hell," Nicholas swore, spinning to look at her. "You liked that, didn't you?"
She shrugged, maybe a little, enough to want to try it again, and actually aim this time. Wisdom, however, prevailed, and she surrendered the gun to the more experienced marksmen as they ran. Nicholas led them across the garden's green lawn and through the trees, until they were outside of the park and darting across the street. He followed the curve of the road, shouldering through startled onlookers, and ducked into a tight alleyway. When he crouched down beside some stacked crates, she followed, her chest burning so fiercely she was afraid she'd be sick.
"Bloody hell,"
he said, shaking harder than before as he touched a cut on his shoulder. Had the bullet actually grazed him?
"Who?"
she panted, leaning forward, trying to see around the crates. Nicholas leaned his head back against the dank stone wall behind them.
"My father, Augustus Ironwood."
Etta had suspected. She'd seen those eyes and recognized the look of Cyrus, his nose, his brows, on the younger man.
But more than that, she'd seen the flash of anguish cut across his face as he called her by her mother's name.
"Are you all right?"
she asked, touching his arm.
"Not the first time that man's nearly killed me," he said offhandedly. "But hopefully it will be the last. Christ, I didn't think I'd ever see him again. Bloody time travel. Bloody...
Oh my God." Etta thought she'd understood this before, that even after a traveler died, there was still the chance of bumping into them again at some point in history. Each passage was fixed to a specific year and location, but not a date. What were the chances that they'd managed to land on the exact same time that a past version of his father had decided to show up?
"The irony of seeing him."
Nicholas shook his head, accepting her touch as she ran the backs of her fingers down his face. He caught them, twining them between his own. His gaze was on the opposite wall, but she saw the emotions storming within him. Why would her mother hide the astrolabe in a place where the Ironwoods clearly had access to the passage? Because she hadn't. When Etta closed her eyes, thought of the wall of paintings, traced the line of her mother's stories to the last one she could remember, it brought her here. It was about her being accepted at the Sorbonne for art history. That was the last piece on the wall.
No.
Etta sat up so suddenly that Nicholas turned to her, worry etched on his face. The painting of Luxembourg Garden wasn't the last one on the wall, or at least her mother had told her she was planning to switch it out for that new painting, the one she had done of the desert in Syria. She had told Etta she was going to replace it. She had woven in that story about the earrings, the market in Damascus, the woman who had sold them to her. And as Etta was discovering, her mother apparently wasn't the type to do something for no reason. "Are you listening, Etta? You won't forget, will you?"
"Remember, the truth is in the telling," Etta said slowly. "In other words, what she told me overrules anything she's written."
Maybe her mother had moved the painting at some point after writing the clues out, or had it been meant to be a false lead, on the off chance that Ironwood figured out her set of clues and picked up her trail. In either case, they were in the wrong city, the wrong time.
"We have to go back," she said.
"We missed something. We're not supposed to be here."
"But you said..."
Nicholas's brow wrinkled.
"Are you certain?"
"Positive," Etta said.
"Can we get back to the passage to anchor?" "We can damn well try."
As they both feared, the authorities had been called to Luxembourg Garden after the disturbance, and Etta felt a shiver work through her at the thought of it being written up in the papers, of there being a witness, a record of the event. They'd been so careful until now.
"I wouldn't worry," Nicholas said. "I think... perhaps this was supposed to happen."
She looked up, startled. They were keeping to the very edge of the garden, weaving in and out of the outer ring of trees. The uniforms of the police blended in with the dark suits of the men giving their statements and accounts, offset by the pops of vivid color that were the women.
"In Virgil's letter, he referenced a sighting by my... that Augustus had, of Rose in Paris. Perhaps this was it."
"Perhaps." But that was almost too insane for her to accept. It took away the idea that she had free will in any of this. It seemed to suggest there was a set path that they were already on, and had been on from the beginning.
"Or perhaps it's only a coincidence," he said.
The passage was only humming by the time they found it, rippling in the darkening air. Nicholas forced her to wait a moment while he prowled through the trees, his pistol drawn, to make sure they were alone. When they finally stepped through the passage, the crushing pressure felt familiar, like a too tight embrace, but not like an attack against each one of her senses. The entrance spit her out at full speed, and Etta found herself slipping forward onto the stone, pinwheeling her arms to try to slow down. Her weight carried her forward until her toes hung over the edge of the terrace, forcing her to sit to avoid falling on her face.
"Etta, where are you?"
The darkness in her vision wasn't from traveler sickness, then. The sky was as black as coal around them.
"Same day," she thought wearily.
"Different time zone." A heavy set of clouds blocked out the moonlight and the stars. In response, her other senses came alive again. The sweet, rotting smell of the jungle as it decayed and bloomed in turn. The sound of small raindrops striking the stones and leaves. Nicholas's hands brushing the top of her head as he felt around in the darkness.
I am praying to God that that's you and not another tiger.
Etta laughed. As if in response, a cloud peeled back just enough for a thin shaft of moonlight to sneak down and make the puddles glow.
Quick, where's the harmonica? Said Nicholas.
He released a single powerful breath and winced as the passage screamed back in response. Her ears, already sharp, were beyond sensitive when all of her other senses were swamped. It reminded her of all the times that Oscar had demonstrated a technique and asked her to close her eyes to truly focus her ears on the difference in tone or sound quality. The layers she had heard before were easier to separate now, like sections of an orchestra. There. She'd been right before.
Do you hear that? Etta asked. Nicholas said, All I hear are Satan's hammers and the war drums of hell, thank you.
Etta shushed him. He fidgeted impatiently.
I mean no disrespect, but perhaps...
Listen, Etta said, and then began to hum, matching the pitch of the low, growling snarl. It changed without warning. She adjusted the sound until it was sharper, higher, a match to a trilling his ear had ignored. Each gate seemed to deliver a veritable mess of sounds as they struck the air, but these two were so different in their nature, cast at such different pitches, that she was angry with herself for not investigating it before. There were two calls woven together, two passages.
So there is another one here, he said. I can hardly hear it.
Etta turned, trying to decide where it was coming from. The stones bounced the sound around, disguising its true source. Nicholas swung his gaze around wildly, searching for the ripple of air, the glimmer of the second passage's entrance. When he turned back to her, he was smiling.
I know where it is.
You do not, Etta said, standing on her toes and searching herself.
I do believe that one goes under my tally, he said,
obviously enjoying her outrage. Have you been keeping score? She demanded.
You haven't.
All right, fine. I figured out how to find the one in London.
We found the passage to Paris together, and the old man figured out the location of the passage in my time, he said. So no points awarded for those. We're one for one, pirate. An even draw.
That didn't sound so terrible after all. How are you so sure? She asked.
You may be a lady with the ears of a dog, but I've the eyes of a hawk, he said,
pointing up at the top of the Viminakas, the temple across the way. Hundreds of steep stairs led up to the grand entrance, and to a wavering blanket of air that sparkled like its own starry sky.
And I do believe that is the passage we've been searching for.
Damascus, 1599. 16. It seemed to Nicholas that the key to passing through these time gates and landing on your feet lay squarely in the approach, and required a great deal of faith in your balance. A confident stride through the rippling air resulted in only the slightest push as you came to the other side. You emerged at a brisk walk, rather than feeling as if you were being shot from a cannon. There was no way around the disorienting pressure and darkness on the journey, but if your mind knew to expect it, there were ways to prepare for the strike. Etta released a soft, oof, as her feet struck the floor, and they were suddenly wrapped in cool, dry air. Nicholas's grip on her hand tightened as the world fell into place around them. They weren't falling off the side of a cliff. They hadn't been shot dead on sight, run through by sword or bayonet. And they hadn't emerged into a crocodile-filled swamp, or in the middle of a crowded market, or, for that matter, in a burning building. So he supposed he should be grateful, but he was mostly exhausted. He had no way of knowing what time it was, only that it was clearly night. Hopefully the same night as the one they had just left in Cambodia. Distant voices prickled his ears, the words muffled by distance or cast in a lyrical language he couldn't decipher. It was as if the air itself had been seasoned with the richest and rarest of spices, so thick he was certain he could taste it on his tongue. The breeze carried other scents that were familiar and strange all at once. There, beneath the warm sweat of beasts of burden and smoke, were notes of a heady floral fragrance. His eyes eventually adjusted to the darkness, well enough for him to make out the shapes around him.
The room was large, and there appeared to be an elaborate wooden bed in the far corner, as well as some sort of desk or table, so laden with piles of objects that he couldn't quite tell what it was. Etta fumbled around the room, and with a flash of white, pulled a sheet off the chair it covered. She did the same with another sheet, uncovering a low table stacked with newspapers and books. "Some sort of home," he ventured. The passage's gate thrummed behind them. The sound wouldn't fade entirely, but within an hour it would start to lessen. "An apartment," Etta agreed, stepping closer to the bed. "Here. Here, matches." She held up a small book of them. "Do you see any candles?" Matches had yet to be invented in his time, but Julian had showed him how to use them during their travels, how to strike the small strips of wood against the rough strip on the jacket containing them. Clever little buggers. As Nicholas marveled again at this small luxury, singeing multiple fingertips as he located a few half-melted candles, Etta moved toward the shutters lining the far wall. "Don't," he said, catching her arm. "Not yet." They didn't need to open themselves up to being caught by someone passing on the street below. Etta stepped back, holding her hands in the air. "All right, all right. Should we light a fire?" Nicholas glanced toward the small fireplace, but shook his head. They could use the additional glow from the hearth to see, but the smoke might also draw undesirable attention. "Leave it for now. If you're chilled, I'll warm you." Etta laughed, pushing him away playfully. What surprised him, perhaps more than his disappointment, was the way her eyes lit at his words, sparking the way the matches had. "Stop this," he commanded himself, ripping away the nearest bedcloth to reveal a distinctly European leather chair. What did it matter that she was clearly as intrigued as he was, that she'd looked at him as though he was the last treasure to be had in the world? Why be so eager to allow her to capture his heart, when it would lead to precisely one thing? Nothing. And yet, he was gripped by the images glittering through his mind, flashing like the sunlight on open water. The memory of her melting beneath his hands, how she tasted of rain and earth and sweetness. There were countless mirrors and portraits to be uncovered, all of which had been taken from their hooks and leaned against the wall, frames and all. English ladies from his time, powdered and pouting. French princesses whose silk gowns seemed to drip from their bodies. Fierce Spanish ladies. So the owner clearly recognized beauty when he saw it, tried to collect it and hoard it. He, or she, he supposed, also seemed to love nothing so dearly as landscapes of green pastures. Nicholas made a disgusted face as he turned the next painting around to reveal yet another scene of sheep idling in a flower-spotted field. Leaving the paintings for a moment, he turned to a large bench-size object covered with another cloth. Upon whipping off the cloth, he found himself staring into the snarling face and exceptionally long, talon-like teeth of a tiger. He fell back onto the ornately woven red rug beneath them and lay on his back, stunned, as a shower of fine dust fell over him. "You get that out of your system?" Etta asked, stepping around his prone form. His hand lashed out, closing around her ankle like an iron. The woman was mad if she thought he'd let her take another step forward. "It's dead," she said, looking down at him with an amused smile. "As gross as it is, it's been preserved and stuffed to be displayed. Look." He inhaled sharply through his nose as she reached out a hand to stroke its head. As promised, it did not move. It did not blink. The tiger was dead.
"What are the chances your mother killed and stuffed it herself?"
"Pretty good, I think." Etta held up a framed photograph of an older man in the garb of an early 20th century explorer who was holding a rifle. The tiger lay dead at the toes of his boots, and beside it was a grinning, tiny blonde girl, a younger version of the woman in the other photograph he'd seen. Rose. And he wondered from whom Etta had inherited her casual disregard for danger. She hesitated before reaching out to run a hand along its curved spine. The coat was orange, striped handsomely with black all the way down to its clawed paws. Having missed the tiger that Etta had seen in the jungle, Nicholas allowed himself to marvel. He'd read of Europe's menageries, seen descriptions and etchings of the exotic beasts, but to see one for himself. And yet, what right did a man have to take the life of such a powerful creature, to prop up his own esteem? I guess this explains Mom's connection to Cambodia. And there I was, hoping Benjamin Linden was a Buddhist. I'm going to yell at her for this, Etta vowed, giving the thing an affectionate pat on the head. Tigers are endangered now, you know.
Well, all right. The older gentleman in this photo is likely your great-grandfather, given what we know about how your mother was raised, he said, passing it back to her waiting hand.
She squinted at it, rubbing a thumb over its dusty face. I can see it, she said quietly, studying Benjamin Linden's face. He has her eyes, her mouth. Features she had inherited herself. Etta seemed both intrigued and rattled to finally have proof of him, proof that her family existed beyond her and her mother.
Alice is right. They should have destroyed it, Etta said.
He hesitated a moment before clarifying.
The astrolabe.
She nodded, and the now familiar poison of guilt and dread worked its way through his system. He would have preferred to avoid the topic altogether, rather than think about his own deceit. How it would crush her to know he had to bring it to Ironwood.
You won't be able to use it if you do,
he was quick to point out. And Ironwood will never let you or your mother escape.
I know you're right, but I can't see a way out of this without huge consequences. I still have a few more days. Not that many, but a few. I just need to figure out how to avoid giving it to Ironwood, but save Mom, Etta said, sensing his thoughts. And then, I guess we'll disappear.
His heart clenched at the word.
What about the violin? Performing?
What about a different future? One I never could have predicted? He drew his legs up, bracing his arms over his knees. Some part of him knew the truth of what Chase had seen. He felt an equality between himself and Etta. But now and then, in moments like this one, when she casually tossed out ideas he didn't understand and was too ashamed to ask about, he fully realized the differences between their upbringings, how much their worlds had been shaped by where and when they'd been born. She knew things beyond his imagining. What could he give to her, other than history lessons? He'd lied to her, of course, about not wanting to know. Nicholas did, even if it meant living with the knowledge of all that his life lacked. A part of himself he did not recognize, one he'd learned to silence as a boy, began to demand the attention he'd always denied it.
I want to know. I want to seek. I want to find.
For the first time since Hall had taken him from that frigid house of terror, he felt the touch of a changing wind blowing through him, pushing him toward a different path. All of these things he desired, he could have. If not on a ship, then by seeking out the passages that could carry him where he wanted to go. And he would have her, the lady with whom he wished to travel. He spotted the leather notebook a short distance away, near the foot of the side table. It was embossed with the emblem of the Linden family, their tree, but the interior pages were blank, waiting to be filled with dates and memories, waiting for a traveler to mark his trip through the passages.
This must be one of your family's homes, he told her. Ironwood seized all property belonging to the other families, but it's possible that, like the passages we used, he doesn't know that this one exists.
Etta spun around slowly, taking in the room, breathing in its air, as if trying to become part of it. Nicholas looked back down at the journal in his hand. He could return to the Dove, but he doubted the old man would have left his small bag and belongings untouched if he thought he could somehow use them to control Nicholas. No, he could seek out Chase and Hall one last time to tell them what his intentions were, and then go. He loved the rough beauty of the sea as he loved nothing else in his life, even as it punished him, even as it reminded him of his insignificance in the face of its stormy wrath. It waited, always, for men brave enough to conquer its shimmering skin, for men to use it as their tool to discover fortune, land, themselves. Surely there were places left to be discovered in his own time, islands and kingdoms of ice, routes to be charted that would close the distance between civilizations. Would that not feed the ache he felt inside him at the realization that this was the final clue, that this hunt, this small journey through fear and wonder was nearly at its end? No, he thought, rubbing the back of his hand against his forehead. Who could be satisfied with seeking out the four corners of one small world when there was the whole of time to be had? No, indeed.
Oh, wow. Etta again broke into his thoughts as she knelt down beside him.
And what is that?